Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So, welcome to the Fleet Science Center. I'm Mike Kalichman, Director for the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology. I want to welcome you to the seventh in a series of nine programs on the topic of the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. This program is one of two that are focusing on the importance of engaging the public and helping them in the domain of science literacy and science interestedness and helping them to be better prepared. Before we start the program tonight, I want to quickly assess how many of you have attended previous programs in this series. It looks like almost everybody. Thank you for returning again. So to make sure we get on with the program tonight as quickly as possible, I want to welcome Stanley Malloy, who has been involved with the Ethics Center for quite a few years since some of our earliest stages of involvement. He has spoken in the program before. Tonight he's going to focus on something that links up directly with an upcoming event in San Diego, the Science and Engineering Festival, the San Diego Science and Engineering Festival. And so Stanley will be talking to you about the palliative power of understanding science, healthcare disparities. So, Stan.
So I want to give you a 20,000-foot view of a really important problem. And that problem is that if you don't have an understanding of science, then your healthcare and the healthcare of your family and many of the key decisions in society are compromised. You have to trust somebody else with things that may go wrong, and if you knew a little more, you could influence them. Right? This is particularly a problem when you talk about healthcare disparities. Healthcare to underrepresented minorities, underrepresented groups because of income, because of a lot of other situations, right? And so I want to give you the 20,000-foot view of this so that then we can spend most of the time talking about it as a group. I should say, in terms of healthcare disparities, the one thing that I have that gives me some credibility in that area is that I'm a principal investigator, one of four, of a big study to understand cancer disparities in the San Diego region. And that's together with San Diego State University and the Moores Cancer Center at UCSD. So the basic problem is really outlined nicely in Henrietta Lacks' book. So Deborah Lacks, Henrietta's daughter, at some point was trying to understand what this meant about HeLa cells, right? I mean, are these little things in a vial some part of her mother that needed to be treated in the way that you would treat your mother? Or what were they? I mean, that's not an easy thing for a lot of people to understand. So it made sense for her to go to the physicians and scientists at Johns Hopkins University where those cells were first isolated. So she goes to a physician, says, "Can you explain to me what these HeLa cells are?" Now, this physician, from the book, gets out a medical genetics book and reads to her. "Its atypical histology may correlate with the unusual malignant behavior of the carcinoma." All right. Now, those are all big words that have complexities of meaning that are really very difficult to decipher. They're not trivial things to decipher if you've gone through high school biology. And if you haven't had high school biology, it's gobbledygook, right? It's not a physician that is explaining something in a way that the patient can understand. So Deborah goes through a lot of these experiences with physicians and scientists. And so finally she says, "This is just crazy. I can't understand them." So she goes to the obvious place everyone goes to, Google, right? And so you say, what does she find on Google? Well, first of all, if you look at the scientific sites on Google, a lot of them are just as complicated as what her physician told her. So listen to this. Due to their ability to replicate indefinitely and the non-human number of chromosomes, and it goes on from there. Okay. Now, from Deborah's perspective, this is almost like an insult to her mother. Non-human chromosomes? What does this mean? Right? And so it's, I think, a wonderful example of the real difficulty we have both in conveying science in person at the level of the scientist and physician and in the science speak that is often encountered on Google. But, of course, Google has a lot of other aspects too. And you can find anything you want on Google. So if you look for simple answers, you can find simple answers. But those answers are often not scientifically and medically reliable. They're the kinds of stories that people tell when they're trying to promote some alternative therapy. They don't explain the science we know about best. Right? So look, take for example, I associated with this, I Googled cancer cure. These are the top things that came up. Did we get, in our first hits on cancer cure, did we get any explanation of what chemotherapy is or why it works? Did we get any explanation of radiation therapy? Was there any sense of an explanation of what the probability is that this will help you or how you respond to the illness if one of your relatives is undergoing these kinds of treatments? No. We find a whole series of alternative treatments that, in fact, if there is a reliability, they have not yet been scientifically proven. Right? So if you go to Google and you get answers like this, they may satisfy you, but not help you. Right? And in fact, they may keep people from going to the place where they're going to get the kind of treatment that's really going to help them and cure them. Right? Now, let's take a couple of examples. The importance of understanding science in your medical care. Every time you go and you get antibiotics, they say, be sure to take that full course of antibiotics. Most people don't. Probably because most people really don't understand why. Right? You're told, well, if you don't do it, the bacteria will become resistant. Well, what does that mean? And why does a full course of antibiotics have anything to do with that? If you don't understand why, you're less likely to comply with the necessary medical treatment. Why don't you take antibiotics for viruses? I'm just as sick as with anything else. Why can't I get antibiotics? How safe are vaccines? If I'm taking my kids in for a vaccination, how safe are they? All right, I'm given this one drug. I still feel pretty bad. If a little bit of it's good, why don't I just take more of it? What about that cure that you read about in Google? Is it valid? Is it not valid? And another thing we're told a lot is something about probability. Well, you have a 10% chance of dying in the next 100 years, right? What does that mean, right? How do you relate to that probability? Probability of this versus what else, right? These are all concepts that there is a basic underlying science behind them. And if you understand the science, then you can influence your own medical care in important ways. Okay? If you understand the science and you go in and they tell you to take a full course of antibiotics and you've been taking those antibiotics for a week, and you still don't feel good, but they gave you 2 weeks' worth of antibiotics, you're likely to keep taking them and not go back in. While in reality, for most infectious diseases, if they're not working in a week, they're not going to work. You need to get something else. Okay? That's something physicians know. That's something people in that field know. But the average person doesn't know it. And so we don't have that ability to influence our own medical care. Now, this is particularly a problem for underrepresented groups. And I could show you lots of data on different cases, but here are just two examples. This compares white, Asian, black, and Hispanic groups, and you're looking here at infections following surgery, the rate. So the higher you are in the curve, the worse it is. And if you look at this, the little blue boxes at the bottom are the white population. And if you look at the other populations, in fact, you can see that their medical treatment is not as effective as a rule. The same thing's true if you look at respiratory failure following surgery. We can go on and on and on. The probability of getting the wrong drug when you're in the hospital is much, much higher if you are an elderly minority. You could say, why is that? Well, if you understand your medical care and you have a good scientific understanding of what the drug is, then you're going to ask questions. And if you don't have that and somebody brings you the little paper cup and says, well, here's your pills for tonight. And you say, well, normally my pills are white and they're purple tonight, but, well, I guess they know what they're doing, right? So you don't ask those questions simply because it's really hard to interpret the answers. Or what will you do if they say one thing versus another, right? It's not just medical care either. It's a whole slew of other things that face us in the newspapers, on television, on Google, in every aspect of our life. Do cigarettes really cause cancer? I hope that's nailed shut now. People who didn't believe it are probably nailed shut in their coffins. Why did we quit using the really important and valuable insecticide, DDT? Is acid rain a problem? An argument that started a long time ago. It's very difficult to understand if you don't know the science behind it. A very hot button issue is IQ determined by race? People can sit and argue about it all the time, but there are scientific evidence that you can use to make the argument and to understand the argument. Global climate change. Here's a new one, airport checkpoints. The radiation you get from walking through those little machines, is that going to hurt you? How would you know that? If you look on Google, you can get both answers, yes and no, right? How do you know what's right? We have the big problem in San Diego with people worried about toilet to tap. How can it possibly be true that toilet water could be safe to drink? That's just offensive, right? And another key thing is the discussions of stem cells and the different types of stem cells. Sure, you could talk about this one's okay, this one's not okay, but what does it really mean about those different types of stem cells? These are basic, fundamental questions. These aren't esoteric science questions. These are things that we all need to know to be able to deal with life on a regular basis. Now, the reason we have a problem right now with this is that our public understanding of science really isn't adequate to answer these questions. So why? Why is that? I mean, we thought we were a very advanced scientific country. Why is it that we're having these problems? And where did we start and where did we go wrong? The big thrust of the United States in science was the Soviet satellite Sputnik. Okay? There was good science going on in the United States before that, but you know, scientists weren't the main focus of what was happening in science, in society. And then there was this little satellite, Soviet satellite, orbiting the Earth, and ham radio operators could get the signal. Beep, beep, beep. It was a reality. It was something you could hear, you could sense, you could feel. Right? And the idea that the Soviets could be more advanced than the U.S. turned the United States science 180 degrees. there was a huge emphasis on science, not only people working in labs, but about society learning of science. That little guy in the top, if you're a certain age, you probably recognize him. Who is it? Tom Terrific. Tom Terrific was a cartoon who taught kids about science with great lessons. He was on Captain Kangaroo, if you don't remember that. We had a lot of other programs where we taught kids about space and space travel. This is a Walt Disney publication, Our Friend the Atom. Life magazine, which was present in most middle-class homes in the country. Every issue of Life magazine, there was something about science or health. Reader's Digest, read widely by the U.S. population when we used to read. Every month, it had a little article that said, I am Joe's liver. And it talked to you about what happens when liver failure occurs or what the liver does normally for us. Right? I am Joe's spleen. How many of you know what the spleen does? Well, how many of you don't know what the spleen does? You know, the spleen is an important and key part of our body. We can't live without it, right? And so this is something that was a key fundamental part of understanding of science because it was out there and it was part of what we did on a day-to-day basis. Okay? And it led to a lot of discoveries, not only about space, but in fact, this was really played a big role in things like the discovery of DNA by Watson and Crick. Okay. Now, there's one other thing I want you to note in these figures. Okay. Take a look at the sex and the race of the people that you see in those figures. They're white males. Okay. These were what we saw as being the people who were the leaders of the science revolution. Now, one of the things you have to do if you want to change science, and Sputnik stimulated a lot of education. So we started science high schools, and we really taught people in high school. What do you notice about the sex and the race of these people? The same thing. So in a situation where we were really focusing very hard on teaching people about science, when that was an emphasis of the United States, the focus was really not role models for underrepresented groups. It was not really bringing this into underrepresented groups. Now, there are exceptions, but those exceptions are people who are downright heroic in terms of their efforts to move forward and understand science. Okay. Now, Sputnik was great. It increased science to a certain level. And then all of a sudden, science lost its popularity. And one of the big reasons that it lost its popularity was because of naysayers, right? There's a whole group of people who said, look, why should I believe the scientist? I think my idea is just as good as theirs. That is a fundamental lack of understanding of science. Science is based upon experiment, on test, on somebody else seeing what you've done and retesting it, right? And so it's not a matter of opinion. And one of the greatest things a scientist can do is prove themselves wrong. That seems just not the way you would expect it to be. But in fact, you work really hard to build a theory, and if you can break down that theory before somebody else does, then that's really an achievement, right? Other big problem is, as we started with Henrietta Lacks, the problem of the scientists and physicians explaining HeLa cells to Deborah, scientists have gotten even worse at explaining science. We've accumulated so much more detail, so much more information, that as scientists we feel like, well, we've got to tell you the whole story, so we're going to just drown you in information, most of which won't be very comprehensible to what you're doing. If you are in the process of recovering from heart disease, an important aspect is autophagy focused on the mitochondria of your cells. Okay? Now, that's an important thing. We can now begin to use stem cell therapy to do something about that. But does that mean anything to any of you? Probably not. On the other hand, if I was to tell you that after heart disease, your cells accumulate a lot of damage. And if that damage accumulates, the cells will just die. And so there's this mechanism cells have where they take out the trash. If there's too much trash, they can't get it out fast enough, right? And so there is this process that we can begin to manipulate so that it gets rid of the harmful trash that kills the cells and will increase your chance of heart attack, of surviving heart attack, surviving heart attack. Now, that makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? Right? You can relate to taking out the trash. In fact, it's just as scientifically valid. It's just a matter of saying what you have to say in terms that somebody else could understand, that your mom could understand, or your sister could understand, or whoever else. Scientists have a big problem with this issue. All right. I talked to you about several problems. One, we have a huge issue with an understanding of science that everybody is confronted with to deal with their health care and important problems in society. Two, underrepresented groups of all types have an even bigger problem with this issue, in part because of poorer education for underrepresented groups, in part because of access to health care and many other issues. Okay. Three, scientists as a whole are not very good at explaining these really important things to society, to all of us that function together to make society whole. Okay. So you say, okay, how can we solve these problems? And I think that there are potentially many answers. I want to tell you about two of the answers that are going on right now in San Diego and I believe will have a huge impact on where we are going. Number one is better training of underrepresented students in science and mathematics. Okay. Now, the moderator today, Dr. Estrelita Martin, runs a program at San Diego State called CASA that brings together a lot of programs to help train underrepresented groups. It's phenomenally successful. The number of students who are moving on to Harvard, to Princeton, to other places, staying in our community, but being a big success, has gone way up because of a focused effort to do this better. So that's number one. That's a big part of our future. Number two is things like the San Diego Science and Engineering Festival. So how many of you have been to the San Diego Science and Engineering Festival? How many of you are going to go two weekends from now? It should be more. This is a wonderful event. This is really a celebration of science. It's an opportunity for people, citizens, students, people at all levels, to actually get together and mingle with the scientists and physicians who are making great discoveries and doing training. Okay? To sit there and ask them one-on-one in a situation where they know their job is to explain this in a way that people can understand. Okay? I'm showing you here a couple of examples from Science Festival. The first festival was here in Balboa Park some years ago. That festival was so popular and so big that it closed down the freeway to get to Balboa Park. Okay. That many people are having access to science, exciting science, fun science, relevant science, in a way that you wouldn't normally experience. Where would you go for that? This is an example of the San Diego Science and Engineering Festival now down at Petco Park. It's a little less crowded. You can get there on the freeway without getting trapped, but the science is just as exciting, and there are wonderful, great opportunities in a lot of different areas. This has something for everybody, but one really important thing is reaching out to kids to get them excited about science, hands-on science, solving real problems, so they will grow up to be the next generation of leaders that will help solve this problem. Now, those are a couple of examples of things going on in San Diego. It would be really great for us to talk as a group about ways you think we can help solve this problem, other ideas, what you think might really help. This event right here is another wonderful example of this kind of outreach. The opportunity for us to talk, it's the key thing is it's not just me talking about you, talking to you, because I'm going to shut up in a minute, and you're going to ask questions. It's us talking together and having a conversation that will really help enhance our broad understanding. Now, nobody's going to write all these things down. I'd just like to point out that there are a number of really wonderful recent publications that deal with these issues. I'm happy to share them with anyone who wants. If you haven't gone to the Science Festival, get on the website. See what it's about. I think it's a great way to spend a Saturday. I think you'll really have fun. If there are kids in your family or neighbor kids or whatever, drag them there and you'll enjoy it with them. One other thing that's not on here that I want to put a plug for is there's an op-ed in Voice of San Diego that came out yesterday evening that Tate was important in writing. He gave the talk a couple of times ago, and it really deals nicely with these issues. It provides an opportunity for you to get on and have a conversation about what you think these issues are, where we need to go in the future, and what the real opportunities are. Okay. I'm going to finish with just one last little thing. I hate it when somebody gets up to talk, they give their talk, and then they rush out of the room. Well, I have a 9 p.m. flight to go meet with the Prime Minister of the Republic of Georgia to try to bring funds back to the United States to train students in science. And so when we finish tonight, I've got to jump in a car so the plane doesn't leave without me. I delayed my flight, so I get there at 4 in the morning for an 8 in the morning meeting with the Prime Minister. So I really am going to have to leave at that time. Okay? I look forward to our conversation. Thanks.
I think we've all had experience with when what we knew was true turns out not to be true. And I think that frustrates a lot of people when they learn something or feel like they have an understanding of science and then find out that that was false and that something else might be true. And a lot of people develop sort of a mistrust of science because it seems like the answer is always changing. I don't know what the answer to that, but I think it's a big part of it is sort of that fundamental of teaching people that science is a process, it's not an endpoint. And, you know, we know something today, but that may not be what we know tomorrow. And that's a complex thing for some people to grasp. But I'm interested in your thought about how we might approach that part of it, of getting people to understand that it's not just an answer, it's a process.
For me, when I'm teaching classes or anything like that, and students come into that same thought process, I like to use the example that as we grow older and we have more experiences, things that we thought were true that have nothing to do with science we find out is untrue, or look at it from a different angle, and science is no different than that. And I think when students come to the realization that nothing is an absolute, then they're more open to trying to at least learn it for now and know that this could be temporary. And that's why we have very few true laws in the science field.
So I really think that that's true. I guess I would add that I think it's extremely complex. And it's complex because people have to understand that science changes. That's one of the things that I really like about science is you never know what you're going to learn the next day. We're never going to run out of things to learn. The difficulty with it is that just because science changes, and sometimes we learn something new and different, that does not mean that some general concepts are just turned over on their head by one person's opinion. Sometimes there is a new experiment that revolutionizes the way we think. When that happens, it has to, before the revolution is done, it really has to have the buy-in of scientists. And so I think that you hit it right on the head. It's this process that's so complicated. It's the change, while the change is based on stability. If you have change without a foundation, then it's going to just be chaos. And I think that the foundation is pretty solid. It's the things on top of that foundation that are changing. But if we had a good way of teaching that, I think it would go a long way. So if any of you has the great idea, we would love to hear it.
Hi, my name is John Denasse. I grew up in San Francisco. I'm one of those Sputnik educated kids that grew up. I worked in the biomedical field, in the health information field for 32 years and now retired. My question is, there's something, when I went to school as a kid and into college, there's something that has happened since then, back up to the 70s, where science was treated more seriously in those days. I remember the Jacques Cousteau specials and the Carl Sagan specials and stuff like that. Now you don't see that on TV. Instead, you see the big focus on sports and entertainment. Yeah, American Idol is on tonight. Yeah, guess what? You're going to have more people watching that than studying science books. Yeah. There's something that has happened to this country where there's this focus on entertainment and sports versus science. Yeah, and can you comment on that? Also, there's also the economic rationale for why to study science. Most people study science to get into three things: engineering, medicine, or computer science. Forget everything else. You know, biology, what's that for? Yeah, except for medicine. Yeah. So my main question is, you know, how can we get people to focus on those other aspects of science?
My gut reaction is, in order to get people interested in science, okay, we need to put it on, it needs to be in those venues that people watch, which is television, Facebook, whatever, in a manner that they can understand, for one. The other thing is, since I'm not in control of the media, I'm unable to always convince them that this is a better thing to do. So folks work in those venues from economic point of view, and whatever's bringing in the money at the time is what they're going to give us. And if we don't take control of what we actually see on TV, then we get what we get.
Even mass media, like the movies, yeah, Planet of the Apes, yeah, they paint science the really poor way, yeah. And so,
because we're mad.
Yeah, and what's happened to this country since Sputnik? I mean, have we gone a direction that, yeah, it's taking this country in a weird direction?
You know, I think that therein lies the crux of the issue, is if we could resolve that, then we would go back to a more educated population. Our greater sensitivity to underrepresented groups means that we would be able to really have an influence on society as a whole if we can resolve that problem. One of the big issues is that it has to be money-making for it to appear on TV. But there are a few things that are good. So Planet of the Apes wasn't so good. I don't know how many of you saw Contagion. A friend of mine is the scientific advisor for the movie Contagion. He is a world-class scientist. And so there's some funky parts in that movie, sure, you know, where the actress's makeup isn't good. But the science is pretty good in that movie. One of the other parts of my life is working with a group in Washington, D.C., for a website called Microworld to try to teach the world more about microbes. It hits kids. We do interviews of scientists. The number of hits for those interviews is really great. There are websites going on. Right now, I'm working with a group to try to get a video game that will focus on this area. I think that the answer is we all have to work really hard. And I hope that given your experience, you'll be one of the people that goes out and works really hard to make this happen.
Yes, hello. My name is Philip Koshula. I'm a psychologist actually in town, and very impressed by the questions and the audience and the speakers. What I have sort of touches on several issues. One is the issue of science changing, and it gives a very easy leg up on skeptics because they say, well, they're going to change their minds tomorrow. You know, now they believe in evolution, tomorrow they'll believe in something else. And I think the important issue is critical thinking, which should be taught across disciplines, not just science. Even in literature, you can be critical about what you're reading. And people who are skeptics may pat themselves on the back and say they have a very high standard of proof and this is not good enough. But I read in Scientific American just yesterday, Michael Shermer has a good column, and he talks about how do we know whether the moon is made up of green cheese or not? And people say, well, we brought back all these moon rocks and so on, it's obvious. But he says, but how do we know that below the surface of the moon, which is full of these moon rocks, we don't have blue cheese, or green cheese, actually. Sorry, I got the color wrong. So he goes into this whole thing about how cheese comes from cows and how the cows get up there. Well, we know one cow jumped over the moon, so maybe it's still up there somewhere and so on. But the point is that critical thinking requires rational thinking based on evidence and facts that are grounded in reality. And I think you can challenge anybody of any religion to come up with proof and without offending their feelings. And if they want to, you know, send you a dismissal or something like that, or fatwa, that's their problem, hopefully. But critical thinking should be taught as a basic tool from kindergarten onwards, and I don't see that.
Point well made.
Absolutely. So I'm Jeff Chase, and I really want to thank you for doing this, and I want to thank the Fleet Science Center for sponsoring these kinds of events because they are really important. Your talk and your response to the questions have, for me, engendered so many questions that I could be up here for several hours. But I'll try to, since Stanley has to catch a plane, I'll not do that. But I want to go back to the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. And I'm not a scientist. My background's American literature. But that book made for me so clear and vivid a kind of science that otherwise I never would have understood. And Rebecca Skloot is not a scientist. She's a journalist. And so I wonder if you could speak at all to the importance not only of appreciating, understanding science as a scientist and getting children engaged in those kinds of activities, which I think everybody here would agree is incredibly important, but also the importance of helping people develop the language to, translate's not quite the word I want, but to convey the richness, the excitement, the story, the process, and how much scientists perhaps could work on that as well as journalists. So just a reflection.
I think that's a good point. I should point out, my wife sometimes says, you write all these technical books, why don't you write a bestseller and then we'll be rich? with the idea that it will be for the public. Let me, actually, before we go there, in the last question, what is a good book about genetics? The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. That is a slam dunk, a wonderful book. If you haven't read it, I really recommend it. I think it's understandable to the public for exactly the reason that Jeff Chase just mentioned. But this, you know, I think to me, the idea here is that, you know, scientists have a lot of knowledge. One of our problems is telling the story right to the public. Telling a story isn't you know, just a scientific endeavor. It means that you understand literature, that you understand communication processes, that you really have thought about what the best way is to lay it out. You know, writing a book like The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, I mean, it's a really big job to have a book that long with that kind of continuity that will present such complicated and technical issues as well as so many ethical issues. I mean, it's a phenomenal book, and that's one reason it's so nice that we're all brought together around that book. We need a lot more of them. If I could make a plug for another book that's actually written by a physician, it's called The Emperor of All Maladies, and it's about cancer. And it really does a very nice job of telling you about cancer treatment. Sometimes we hear it said in the news, how come we don't have a cure for cancer? Right? If you read this book, you'll know, in fact, where we are now versus where we were in the 60s, and I think you'll be blown away. It really is impressive. A wonderful read. I highly recommend it.
To add on to what Stan was saying regarding writing, I think fortunately or unfortunately, it depends on what side of the coin you want to look at it at. As scientists, we tend to write very succinctly, concisely, and we leave out the adjectives. And when we speak, we do the same thing. We get to the point and go through the bush instead of around it. And unfortunately, it makes us not very good writers. And so I think it's important on some level that in the English classes that we require students to take, maybe we should not focus quite as much on scientific writing as we should on creative writing, so that students can see that you can write in both fields and get a point across and explain it on all levels.
Someone came up earlier and said, what can we do? And so I'd say first, vote for policies and politicians that support science. I'm disgusted by some of the illiteracy, scientific illiteracy among people that might actually govern our country. Something I like to do is tweet scientific things. That's what I'm interested in. I don't want to know what you had for lunch, and I certainly don't want to tell you what I had for lunch, but maybe there's something new in the science world that we can start a conversation about. Send your kids to science camp. I volunteer at a science camp. I'm not much of a biological science person, you know, but I go to the camp and I have a great time. And there's a camp called Camp Quest, and they're a science-oriented, skeptical thinking, rational thinking camp. And they're going to open up a new place in outside of Big Bear this summer for the first time. They've been up in Northern California. Volunteer your time at the library, and you can read science books. You don't have to read the other books. You can read science books to kids. And if you can, teach science. Patronize movies that promote science. If you know that there's something in a theater that doesn't get a lot of business, more of an artsy, independent-type film, really support it and call on the theaters to start showing it more. We did that with the last film that they made about Darwin and his life. I didn't think it was that accurate about his life, but it was science-oriented. And I'm going to take some of the suggestions that I heard today about, like, the San Diego Science Alliance. I run a group for kids, and it would be nice to know that I can call on that place to maybe bring a teacher in to teach our kids. So thank you for these opportunities.
Thank you for giving us a list of other alternatives. Some of the events, and I'm speaking more on a personal level now, some of the events that occur are activities that are available. When Stan was talking earlier about cultural groups that are less visible at these events, the question is, where is the advertisement for these going? Looking in this particular audience, it's like the knowledge is still staying within a particular or maybe one or two cultural groups. And so that knowledge is still not getting to the groups that need to receive the knowledge or the information. Some events cost. Transportation could be an issue. Knowing that this is up at Big Bear would not necessarily help the children that's in the ladies' class who had the 40 students in her class who's in southeast San Diego or in the southern part of the Bay. She's already indicated that they have difficulty getting equipment for here or being able to just to come to this institution. So suggesting a place that is either further away without some type of assistance is information that is not as helpful. Let me put it that way. So I think sometimes we tend to neglect to look at what are the logistics. And we have all wonderful suggestions, and we can all come up with things that way, I think. But we need to look at the logistics, and are we also willing to go into the neighborhood that needs it? Are we ourselves willing to go into the neighborhood that needs it instead of asking them to come to the mountain? Is the mountain willing to move? Just throwing that out there.
Okay, so my question kind of focuses on the climate of healthcare now and how it affects the health disparities. So I feel like there's less of a convention to have a family doctor that knows you, knows all your problems, and can identify and treat all those problems. But instead now we kind of go from specialist to specialist that doesn't know you as a whole person but knows the specific parts that are afflicted. So my question is, how can we as patients ask the right questions to these people that don't have the whole picture to get the treatment we need?
Stan, I'm handing that one off to you.
So it's a tough question because it depends on what the treatment is, right? But I think that the biggest issue is asking, not being afraid to ask. And if you don't understand the answers, if you don't understand the science, I think there's an inherent fear of asking because all you do is you make yourself frustrated because you don't understand and you don't want to look like a dummy in front of your doctor, right? And so I think the key, though, is to say, you know what? It's my health. It's my right to know. And you keep asking until it's explained in a way that you can understand. That's what I think. We all need to feel comfortable enough to be able to do.
I think it's clear that one of the problems with the public awareness or the lack of public awareness of science is the responsibility of scientists to intervene in with public outreach. I'm not as clear that that's widely understood or appreciated by enough scientists in the scientific community, and I wonder not just about science education, but about scientist education and what we might do on that front.
I think you make a valid point. When scientists are in training, like at graduate school, et cetera, there is little to know. There might be a few schools. I don't know what they are. But there is little to no conversations regarding how to teach, how to communicate. And then if they are teaching, they're teaching students who are already in the science classes and usually students who are already planning to be scientists or in the health field of some sort. So you have the audience that is willing to go to the library and learn whatever it is that they need to learn to get the grade that they think they want to earn. If they're willing to put in the time. So I think you have a valid point that there should be somewhere in the curriculum of scientist training of science communication to non-scientists. And it is only when we as scientists are willing to teach classes for non-science majors, more willing to do that, where we have to actually take our knowledge and break it down in terms that helps the non-science major understand it more, then we get a lot more students who are willing to take more science classes, or at least willing to read or not just toss it to the side and just learn it for that one semester or so. So I think you make a valid point that our communication skills need to be improved.
So I'll add to that. I hope that I didn't sound one-sided. I don't think it's just a problem with the public understanding science. It's our problem as scientists, right? And the difficulty that you bring up, Tate, is that I think most scientists don't realize it. So I was previously the president of communications for the American Society for Microbiology, a very big organization, right? And so we did a lot of things to try to educate the public about science. So when I stepped down from that, I sent messages out to a lot of people I respect, said, who could be chair of this? Who would be somebody who would understand those outreach efforts and so on? Hundreds of suggestions of this person, oh, they're a great scientist. They never talk to the public. They've never done these kinds of things, but they're a great scientist. This person, oh, they really understand TB, and TB is important. So, you know, they're... So I think as scientists, we don't even know what we need. And so that's a problem. It's an overarching problem that needs to be resolved as much as the public understanding of science. These two things go glove in hand.
I think we have time for two more questions, the last two people that are standing there.
All right, and I had two things, so I'll make them quick. One's a resource. I work with Connect. We're a nonprofit that works with entrepreneurs in life science and technology. We have a program that sends entrepreneurs into the classrooms, and it's called Entrepreneurs for Young Innovators. So if you are teachers here or you know of teachers in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th through 12th grades, and you want a technologist or a scientist to come into the classroom and really inspire the kids in science, technology, engineering, and math, that's another resource free of charge. We go to the school no matter where the school is in the county. So that's a resource. We had a question regarding, you know, so much, you know, sports and entertainment on the TV. Well, get a celebrity up there talking about their medical issue with a scientist. Maybe that's one way to get people more interested. And finally, my own question, which is how do we get teaching into the medical school system where they're getting sensitivity training for the patient that has particular religious beliefs or holistic health beliefs, and how do we get the doctors that are treating patients with multiple specialists involved to actually create almost like a general contractor to the subcontractor, if you will, in an analogy, so that there is someone leading the team of physicians over a patient case. So just a couple thoughts.
I think one of the problems that was mentioned is how to teach people to think logically. Those of us who are old were trained with geometry and the beauty of proofs. I don't think you can sell that anymore, but what you can do is sell Russellian statement calculus and Boolean logic and teach it as a pre-computer course so it has sex appeal. And the beauty of this is it's totally abstract. So no one can have any religious qualms about it whatsoever. However, once they've been taught how to be logical, that's somebody else's problem.
I think those are two very good comments to end on. So I will give the microphone over to this gentleman.
First, I mean, I think we all come here to these programs to learn, and tonight was an outstanding example of that, where both the speakers, I think, learned from the audience learned from the speakers, and the audience learned from other members of the audience, which is really the theme here. And I learned tonight that we need to be clearer about who our program participants are. I apologize to Estrella Martin, who is an assistant dean for science affairs at San Diego State University, or student affairs at San Diego State University. She has a PhD from University of California at Berkeley in cell and developmental biology. As a scientist and somebody interested in students, we thought she would be an excellent moderator, and that proved to be the case tonight. And we knew that Stan Malloy, who's spoken before, would be a passionate speaker for science. So I want to thank both of them for their participation tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.